This week's sunrise will be at 6:45, sunset at 7:20 p.m. Temperatures look to be around 15 centigrade, and it will be rainy.
Welcome to our regular listeners and any new ones we might be picking up along the way. This is the Sandwell News for the blind and visually impaired community for Saturday 13th of September. Well, at least it's not Friday the 13th if you're superstitious. So, a few of the things coming up.
Some stories coming up from the papers. Wednesday, September the 3rd. Less than half of people now carry a physical wallet. A new 600 homes site in Wednesbury moves nearer. Thursday's news, Albion's 125th Memorial Day. E-bikes and e-scooters just a nightmare, says RNIB survey. The King talks to patients at the Newmet Hospital. Saturday's news, NHS support staff in threat to take action. Monday's news, growing problem of pupils' absence from schools. Tuesday's news, bus depot plan to shake up region's bus services. Holidays are people's top priority when it comes to splashing out money.
Well, I must say, that last item about holidays, I haven't had one, a proper one, in 15 years. So splashing out on holidays isn't my priority, but I suppose I'm different. But that's just a few of the stories coming up this week. More besides, of course, courtesy of Express and Star Publications. With the usual inserts of news from Talking News Federation about the upcoming TV and radio programmes for the week, which is a bit longer than usual, and maybe another item of theirs, and I want to squeeze in part of the recording I made last Monday of the canal walk we did from Great Bridge to Ocker Hill in Tipton. Very lengthy recording, and I'm going to include bits of it as time goes by in the next month or so. Let's get started then with the first day's news.
This is James Brodie bringing to you stories from the Express and Star dated the 3rd of September. Cash and drugs are found in stolen car. West Midlands Police have successfully confiscated a large amount of cash and Class A drugs from a stolen car in the Black Country. Officers from the road crime team at West Midlands Police spotted a cloned and recently stolen car in Smethwick before initiating a block to prevent a pursuit, police said. The driver rammed multiple police cars but could not escape. The driver of the vehicle tried to run off before being caught on foot, where officers also found his large amount of cash and Class A drug wraps. Lloyds Bank is moving out, but did you know its first branch was here? This story is brought to you by Mark Andrews, and supporting this article is a picture of the bank with the caption, "The first Lloyds Bank branch in Oldbury believed to have been taken in the 1930s. It will be the end of an era this autumn when Lloyds Bank moves out of its imposing and Telenet building in the Wolverhampton's Queen's Square after 146 years. The bank will still be represented in the city with a smaller branch in the Mander Centre, but did you know that the Lloyds' first ever branch was in the Black Country? To most locals, the shabby building in the Unity Place Oldbury is probably best remembered as the old subway, its peeling green paint a telltale sign of its recent use as a sandwich bar, but this scruffy-looking building played a hugely important role in shaping the world of modern financial services and its first branch of Lloyds Bank. Whilst the Black Country in Shropshire role as the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution is well known, the area's importance in the banking revolution, which took place at the same time, gets far less attention. Britain's biggest high street banking group owes its origins not to the square mile, but to a Quaker industrialist whose father had fled persecution in his native Wales to make a living in the quieter climes of the West Midlands. Today, Lloyds Banking Group employs 65,000 people and it has 30 million customers, but it already had been trading for more than 100 years as a modest family business before it opened its first walk-in branch just off Birmingham Road in Oldbury Town Centre. The story began in Welshpool, where Samson Lloyd Sr. was born in 1664 in difficult circumstances. His parents, Charles and Elizabeth, had been detained for refusing to swear an allegiance to King Charles II, as it's not certain where Samson was born. The majority of the report says that Welshpool Gaol, where his parents served 8 years, but others suggest they might have been under house arrest, but either way, he would have spent much of his childhood in custody. A little respite came with 1672 Declaration of Indulgence, which saw Quakers freed from prison, but not a great deal of Samson's father, who was a descendancy of the Welsh royal family, decided it was time to leave behind the hostility he faced in his homeland and to make a new life in England. However, the Five Mile Act, introduced to restrict the influence of the Quakers, prevented any nonconformist clergyman from living within 5 miles of a corporate borough. That ruled out the major centres of the Black Country, but Birmingham still was a sleepy backwater, yet to be granted borough status, was also beginning to emerge as a manufacturing centre in its own right. Just like the Quaker Cadbury family, the Lloyds decided that the future second city was ideally located to benefit from the Industrial Revolution, which was about to explode just up the road, but was still small enough for them to live a peaceful life free from interference. Indeed, Sampson Senior's brother-in-law, John Pemberton, had already made a successful career as an ironmaster in Birmingham, and it was believed he moved to Birmingham in 1698. His son, Sampson Lloyd II, was born in 1699, and they opened a slitting mill at the end of Bradford Street, powered by water from the River Ree. Following the death of Sampson Senior in 1725, Sampson II and his older brother Charles went into business together, buying another mill in the town and trading in iron. 2 years later, Sampson II married Sarah Parks, and daughter of wealthy Wednesbury industrialist Richard Parks, who died in 1728, leaving what would eventually become the Patent Shaft Steelworks in Wednesbury to his four daughters. Sampson naturally became involved in the management of that business too, and the following year Sarah died too at the age of 29, leaving one son, Sampson III. And in 1765, at the age of 66, Sampson II decided to start a bank. He entered into a partnership with leading Birmingham button maker John Taylor, and the bank, initially known as Taylor's and Lloyd's, began operating from Sevendale End in Birmingham. We do know that there was a growing demand for commercial banking during the 18th century. When Taylor and Lloyd's was formed, 4 shares were issued, with both men bringing their sons into the business, and between them the 4 men invested between £6,000, well over £1 million each at today's prices. 2 clerks were also employed at a cost of £80 a year. It seems incredible given the huge sums of money involved, but such was the trust between the 4 men that no legal deed was ever brought into place during the first 100 years of operations. The Lloyds were soon established as the dominant figures in the partnership, whilst the day-to-day running of the business was left to Sampson Lloyd III. And Sampson Lloyd Senior's hunch that Birmingham would be a good place to do business would pay dividends. By 1765, Birmingham's population had grown to 25,000, and within 15 years this had doubled to 50,000. At one time in the early years, it was said that half of Birmingham was indebted to Taylor and Lloyd's, but one obstacle to Birmingham's growth at the centre of commerce was the state of the roads leading to it, and how the Lloyds family dealt with the problem gives an interesting insight into what made them such a force in the world of business. A coach service to London had been running since 1731, but passengers making this treacherous journey not only had to resign themselves to 2.5 days on the road, but also the likelihood that they would be relieved of their valuables by highwaymen along the way. The long procession of wagons carrying coal from the Black Country collieries also floundered along the rutted roads, making the going still harder for other traffic, so Sampson Lloyd II and son next turned their attention to overseeing the construction of a 22-mile Birmingham Canal. Known as the Silent Highway, the waterways would transform Birmingham's fortunes, halving the price of coal overnight. It also proved a shrewd investment, paying a dividend of 20%. Sampson Lloyd II died in 1779 at the age of 80. But the bank continued to see rapid growth until Sampson Lloyd III and his half-brother Charles. The industrial expansion, which took place during the Victorian era, meant that the nature of banking was changing. In 1864, Taylor and Lloyd's opened its first retail branch in Albury. The Albury branch would prove to be the first of many. Lloyd's acquired the status of Lloyd's Bank, changing its name to Lloyd's Banking Limited, and a network of branches sprang up in the West Midlands. The first Lloyd's branch in Wolverhampton is thought to have opened about 1875, moving to its soon-to-be-vacated site in 1879. The original branch in Albury closed about 20 years ago. Arrests as suspected chop shop discovered. Police arrested 3 men and seized suspect stolen vehicles in Albury amid a suspected chop shop discovery. In the early hours of Saturday morning, officers executed a warrant at a unit on Tap Bank Road. Police said this followed a call from a member of the public reporting suspicious activity. Following a search of the premises, police found several suspected stolen car parts and documents related to vehicles reported as stolen. These were seized for forensic examination. Three men, aged 39, 29 and 17, were arrested on suspicion of theft of a motor vehicle. They have since been bailed pending further inquiries. A spokesperson for the West Midlands Police said, teams across the West Midlands Police regularly carry out warrants and enforcement action targeting known vehicle crime hotspots. Chop shops are illegal garages where stolen vehicles are dismantled for parts and are linked to vehicle crime gangs. Telltale signs of a chop shop could include noise coming from units late at night or in the early hours of the morning, vehicles that look out of place going into the workshop and not coming back out, large amounts of car parts being stored, sometimes in odd places such as gardens. Less than half now carry a cash wallet in their pocket. Younger people ditching money and relying on paying for goods through their phone. This story is brought to you by Christine Dyer. Less than half the people carrying a physical wallet as part of their day-to-day lives, the report says. Just 48% of people surveyed for cash access and the ATM network link considered carrying a physical wallet to be an essential part of their routine. The research indicates that many purses and wallets are gathering dust in drawers, with more than four-fifths of people saying that they do own one. The growing popularity of digital payments and wallets allowing people to pay with cards, phones and watches means that leaving the house without a physical wallet is becoming easier, Link said. The report titled Tapping Into Trouble, the UK's Growing Digital Payment Dependency indicated people aged 46 plus had a preference for physical debit cards, whilst people aged 18 to 44 were more likely to favour digital wallets. One in nine UK adults habitually leaves home with only a digital wallet as a form of payment. The research indicated rising to nearly 3 in 10 people aged 35 to 44. Despite digital payments being the default option for some people, more than half of those surveyed said that they had used cash in the past week. Link also raised concerns that technology firms have left consumers exposed across payments, banking and broader services. More than 6 in 10 people have experienced payment failures, the research indicated. Of those experiencing payment failures, some people abandoned the purchase they were trying to make. The research also found that some people may be relying on a limited choice of payment methods, which could leave them without a backup payment if they're unable to use them. Among those with the digital wallet, 40% only had one card set up on it, and 60% of those using a digital wallet said they only carry this kind of wallet. 7% of people said that they carry no cash at all, whilst 23% have none at home, according to the survey of 2,000. Major scheme to transform site into 600 homes moves a step closer. A major scheme to finally transform a Wensbury site left derelict for four decades into a 600-home development has moved a step closer. Sandwell Council and the West Midlands Combined Authority, that's the WMCA, have appointed Keepmoat as their preferred developer to construct the Friar Park Urban Village scheme. West Midlands Mayor Richard Parker said the site was no easy to bring forward but was pleased with progress being made. The land, approximately the size of 32 football pitches, are joint owned by the council and the WMCA and has previously housed a waste treatment plant, foundry and hospital, but it has laid empty for more than 40 years due to the complexity in cleaning up the land and making it ready for building housing. Once completed, bosses said at least 25% of the new homes will be classified as affordable. The first phase of work on Friar Park Urban Village will be to treat the land to address historic contamination issues. A planning application will then be submitted by the council and the WMCA for the remediation work shortly and will be available for public comments. Mr. Parker said that I'm pleased to see more progress on this project. This is not an easy site to bring forward, but when I met with the Environment Agency, they assured me that they are treating our land clean-up plans as a top priority now. That matters because thousands of families need a safe, warm home and this site can deliver 600 of them. The appointment of Keepmoat is a real step forward. They can now start designing a new community that will help meet our housing needs, create jobs and support the regeneration set out in my growth plan. Recent figures show that across the West Midlands there are 7,450 households, including 14,976 children living in temporary accommodation and 65,335 households on social housing waiting lists. Councillor Peter Hughes, Sandwell Council Cabinet Member for Regeneration Infrastructure, added, "It's great to see another step forward in our ambitious plans to regenerate Sandwell and to be able to offer more homes, green spaces and infrastructure to our residents. This project will be genuinely collaborative between WMCA, Keepmoat, the council and local residents."
Hi, this is Debbie with some articles from the Express and Star from the 4th of September. Baggies fans flock home on a special day for Hawthorns by Lewis Cox. This article is accompanied by three photographs. The first is black and white and shows a football match. The caption reads, "The first ever European fixture against Utrecht." The second is a colour photograph of another football match and the caption reads, "A black country derby against Wolves in 1956. And the third photograph shows a long gallery with pictures on either side, with people walking up and down looking at photographs. Thousands of Albion supporters enjoyed a unique experience and sampled memories of the Hawthorns' 125 years on the stadium's birthday yesterday. A memorial day at the club's iconic home saw fans of all generations marvel at timeless snaps from the early decades of the Hawthorns, which officially opened its doors on September 3, 1900. 125 specially selected pictures were enlarged onto easels and displayed chronologically through four of the suites inside the ground's east stand with a wonderful take-up from supporters. Fans queued to enter the ground from the open house's opening at 8 a.m. and would continue to flock into the evening to allow families with children after school. There was also the opportunity to have a photograph taken with the backdrop of the pitch from the east stand, which proved extremely popular. Staff were taken aback by the turnout to honour the club's proud home, into which Albion moved from Stony Lane after the turn of the new century. A nice touch saw all club staff invited to the stadium just after lunch with a toast to the Hawthorns at 1:25 p.m. New head coach Ryan Mason turned up later in the afternoon, keen to immerse himself in Albion's heritage. John Homer, chairman of the official supporters club who regularly conducts stadium tours and hosts a weekly memories group for those with dementia and Alzheimer's, was on hand to bring the images to life. He told the Express and Star, "It's a wonderful anniversary and they're doing it complete justice. I'm so chuffed that so many people have turned up because for all these people to make the effort, it must be a special place." The photographs are all crystallisations of moments in time. "Everybody I've spoken with has a memory from the photograph they look at, which is wonderful. That brings the exhibition to life." Images included laying the pitch prior to its opening in September 1900 right to the modern day, with everything in between, including league and cup successes, iconic goals and moments, and many blue and white striped heroes depicted. Other memories included the official opening of the floodlights against the Red Army in 1957, the first European fixture against Utrecht of the Netherlands in 1966, mourning the loss of the great W.G. Richardson in 1959, the famous Hawthorns League Cup success of 1966, and shots of the great long-serving secretary-manager Fred Everiss in his stadium office. There were stunning aerial shots of the stadium, harrowing images from rioting Leeds fans in 1982, and the demolition of the Rainbow Stand in 2001. There were also modern-day triumphs, including the historic Great Escape of 2005. Supporter Andy Fletcher, 64, said, "It was fantastic to see the history of the club and stadium. A lot of people on a normal match day, or at any time, don't get to see that, so it was very good of the club to do it and a good experience. Many people haven't seen those photographs. It's our spiritual home at the end of the day. It's the Albion family." Fellow season ticket holder Jake Morris, 24, added, "There was a really big queue, people having photographs. I was quite taken aback. It just shows what the club means to fans and the community. It's really good of the club. This new ownership have opened the doors more to the community and fans. The new ownership have embraced it all and the club are buying into it. The ownership are visible and engaged. You can feel that even coming here today." Season ticket holding couple Christine Perry, 71, and Len Perry, 72, from Dudley, enjoyed the experience. Christine said, "It's been really nice. It was brilliant. I knew my great-granddad, Thomas Cotterill, played for the Albion in 1882, but I saw the actual document that was signed like a contract, so I found that." Tony Pollard, 72, a season ticket holder from Quinton, added, "It was a very good experience. I've been in the suites before, but never seen some of those photographs. Some of them were new and very good. It's been a real insight and I really enjoyed it. I must have taken 100 photos in there today. There was a lot I hadn't seen before. It was very enjoyable and well presented. These are good owners and know what they're doing. They are very appreciative of the fan base and club. It's great to see." Driver arrested after two police cars are rammed. Three men have been charged with criminal offences after separate incidents in Sandwell. One man was arrested after police officers spotted a vehicle that was believed to be stolen being driven in Smethwick in the early hours of Sunday. After failing to stop, the driver rammed two police vehicles before decamping from the car. However, he was detained and a quantity of drugs was recovered. Lewis Wilson, 23, and from Wednesbury, has been charged with several driving offences, handling stolen goods, criminal damage and possession with intent to supply Class A drugs. Wilson was remanded into custody to appear at Birmingham Magistrates Court. Jack Tinsley, 20, and of Dudley, was charged with driving a vehicle without insurance or a licence, failing to stop, dangerous driving and possession of Class B drugs. He appeared at Wolverhampton Magistrates Court on Monday. It comes after drivers spotted another vehicle being driven dangerously on Shakespeare Road, Tipton, in the early hours of Sunday. And Bernard Lyons, 49, from Netherton, has been charged with driving a vehicle without insurance or a licence, dangerous driving and possession with intent to supply of Class A drugs. E-bikes and scooters are just a nightmare. More than 50 pedestrians seriously injured in a single year, by Neil Lansfield. This article is accompanied by a colour photograph of the bottom half of a person in blue shorts standing on an e-scooter. The caption reads, "A fifth of rental e-scooter trips replace car journeys, according to recent report, but they can be a menace to others." Electric bikes and scooters ridden or parked on pavements are causing fear and anxiety for blind, the partially sighted and the elderly, according to a new report. The growing use of micro-mobility transport options is making streets a nightmare, with only 1 in 10 blind people confident walking in their own neighbourhood, charity the Royal National Institute of Blind People, RNIB, said. The vast majority, 92% of 1,197 blind or partially sighted people surveyed for the report, said they have to walk into roads as pavements are obstructed by parked cars, bikes or e-scooters. More than a third of respondents said they had collided with a street obstacle in the previous 3 months. One person described how they now have to rely on a cane because the guide dog was withdrawn after becoming stressed by trying to walk along blocked pavements. Many towns and cities in the West Midlands have introduced dockless rental schemes for electric bikes and scooters. Users are requested to park the vehicles in a way that does not inconvenience other people, but this does not always happen, with bikes and scooters often strewn across pavements. They cause a problem for people who have problems with their eyesight, as well as older people who struggle with their sight and mobility. Eric Mathis, RNIB's policy lead for travel and transport, who has sight loss, said it is getting harder for blind and partially sighted pedestrians and wheelchair users to move independently because of more and more obstacles on the streets. He went on, "I'm always having to double check or think about how I'm going to get around by foot. This is tiring, takes up more time and makes me feel unsafe too. E-scooters and dockless bikes left on pavements have added to the issues, with cars being parked on pavements and advertising boards strewn all over." He added that not knowing an e-scooter or an e-bike is about to pass you at speed is causing mental health issues for some people. The RNIB is calling the government to create inclusive standards for pavements that can be robustly enforced, and urging local authorities to take action such as maintaining access to pavements during roadworks, better monitoring of food delivery courier cyclists, and improved regulation of rental e-scooter and e-bike schemes. A Department for Transport DfT spokesman said, "Safety is our top priority and private e-scooters remain illegal on public roads. We've been clear that with any trial schemes, local authorities must make sure e-scooters don't obstruct others, particularly disabled people. To clamp down on reckless parking, we are bringing forward new powers to regulate e-scooters and e-bikes, letting local areas shape schemes to better meet their needs, whilst tackling badly parked cycles which are disruptive to many road users." Tom Hunt, who chairs the Local Government Association's Inclusive Growth Committee, said, "Councils take their responsibilities to ensure pathways and pavements are accessible for all very seriously. The inclusion in the devolution bill of further regulatory powers for local authorities to manage shared e-scooter and e-bike schemes will help to tackle inconsiderate parking of such vehicles. The government must act on the use of an estimated 1 million privately owned e-scooters which remain illegal to use on our public roads." Latest Department for Transport figures show 52 pedestrians were seriously injured in collisions with e-scooters in England in 2023. Private e-scooters cannot legally be used in public areas in the UK, although they are a common sight in many urban areas. Legal trials of rental e-scooters on roads have been ongoing in towns and cities across England since July 2020. William Porter of IAM RoadSmart said, "E-scooters and e-bikes present real safety issues, particularly for the visually impaired. Dockless rentals are often left blocking pavements, while private ones are frequently used dangerously and illegally, with many exceeding legal speed limits." King jokes, "Bits don't work so well when get past 70" by Stephanie Wareham. This article is accompanied by a colour photograph of King Charles talking to an elderly lady sitting in a chair beside a hospital bed watched by medical staff. The caption reads, "King Charles jokes about ageing with patient Jacqueline Page from Great Bar." The King joked about ageing as he met patients on a visit to a new hospital in Smethwick. The monarch was greeted by cheers and waving flags yesterday before he visited one of the Midland Metropolitan University Hospital's acute elderly care wards, where he met 85-year-old patient Jacqueline Page from Great Bar. Mrs. Page said she was delighted to meet Charles after seeing him in 1978 with her parents when he came to Birmingham to open Perry Bar Stadium. She said, "You came in the helicopter and you got out and came straight towards my parents. They shook hands with you, but I didn't get a look in, so I'm so delighted to meet you today." The King said, "It was a wonderful old helicopter, I seem to remember. I used to fly it because I'd flown them in the Navy. I left the Navy in 1976 and I could still remember how to fly it. That was the great thing." The pair also shared a joke about their health, with Mrs. Page telling the King she was wearing out. The King responded, "I know, this is the terrible thing, as I'm discovering already. The bits don't work so well when you get past 70. The Royal also chatted with patient Matthew Shinder, 73, who's receiving treatment for prostate cancer, is from Oldbury. He told Charles, "It's nice to see you recovering well," to which the King replied, "I'm not too bad." The King asked Mr. Shinder what he liked to drink, to which his daughter said he loves his malts. After asking Mr. Shinder if the hospital staff allow him to have a tiny dram of whisky occasionally, the King said, "I suppose I should have brought one. It's supposed to be good for the heart." After his visit to the ward, the King met the first baby to have been born at the hospital after it opened its doors on October the 6th last year, and her parents, Semhar Tesfu and Jonas Kaflu from Perry Bar. Hernata Jonas arrived at 8:48 a.m, just 90 minutes after the maternity ward opened its doors for the first time. The King greeted the crowds of hundreds of patients, staff, medical students and volunteers who cheered, clapped and took selfies as he stopped to shake their hands and speak to them. Sir David Nicholson, chairman of the Sandwell and West Birmingham NHS Trust, said, "It was a tremendous honour to have the King unveil a plaque marking the official opening." He said, "This is a day of immense pride, not just for those of us who've been part of this project since its inception, but the entire community that will benefit from this world-class facility for generations to come. Your Majesty, it is with deepest gratitude and immense pride that we welcome you here today to officially open the Midland Metropolitan University Hospital." Shop may lose alcohol licence. A shop could lose its licence after illegal alcohol and vapes were found during an inspection. A total of 119 counterfeit bottles of vodka, whiskey and Jägermeister were found at Best One Goshall General Store in Tivadale, Oldbury, during an inspection in February. Oversized vapes and prescription-only Viagra was also on sale when the Tower Road shop was searched by Sandwell's Trading Standards officers following a complaint. The inspection will be discussed as part of a review of the shop's licence by Sandwell Council's Licensing Committee at a meeting in Oldbury on September the 10th. As many as 76 oversized vapes were seized by Trading Standards officers, as well as more than 60 counterfeit bottles of vodka that had not paid UK duty, 40 bottles of whiskey and 17 bottles of Jägermeister, all with false labels and no VAT.
This is Lauren with some stories from the Express and Star from the 5th of September. Minister challenged to try iced lemon bun. A government minister has been challenged to visit the Black Country to sample one of Firkin's famous iced lemon buns during a debate in the Commons. Sarah Coombs, MP for West Bromwich, told Sir Chris Bryant, Minister for Creative Arts, Industry and Tourism, how the town had been gripped by the relaunch of the historic bakery and its delicious sweet treats. We saw people queuing from 7 a.m. for the famous lemon iced buns that Firkins had made for many, many years, she said. Would the minister agree that food and hospitality are at the heart of our high streets? Would you like to come and taste one of those iced buns? Sir Chris replied, I'm really more of a Chelsea bun person than an iced bun. But she makes a very good point that there are businesses up and down the country who are opening anew and opening afresh. And actually, far from dismissing the opportunity of having a national health service that works more effectively, that has a rail service that works effectively, and has a secure set of working rights for people. They welcome that and want people to have a proper wage when they are in work, because they know that motivates the staff better. Boy 15 on trial for knife attack, written by Adam Smith. A 15-year-old boy has gone on trial for attempting to murder a 14-year-old in the latest case of knife-related violence involving children. The trial, on charges of attempted murder and wounding with intent, come after a teenager was found with serious stab wounds in Albury. West Midlands police arrested a 15-year-old boy in Tipton and charged him with attempted murder, wounding with intent, and possessing a knife in a public place. The teenager, who cannot be named for legal reasons, is standing trial at Wolverhampton Crown Court after he pleaded not guilty to the charges. The jury was shown CCTV footage and audio of the alleged attack in Brunel Road in January, which left the victim with serious stab wounds and scarring. The two boys can be heard arguing with each other, and then a boy can be seen stopping his bike and turning round. After the argument, there was screaming after the attack happened, and the prosecution claimed the argument was about cannabis dealing. The boy who was seriously stabbed told the jury he had known his attacker through friends and had gone to buy drugs off him. He said, I knew he had money and cannabis on him. He had a knife and he used it, whereas I had a knife, but I did not ever use it. We went to have a smoke and buy drugs. My mate said he was going to buy 2 drawers, cannabis. There was a fight. I punched him, but he had a knife and used it on me. He added, he had his knife and he stabbed me. I have scarring. I was in hospital because of my injuries. I think I might have been set up because after I got stabbed, I got weird messages in hospital. The boy denies all charges and the trial continues. Teen who stole amputee's mobility car avoids jail term. Disabled victim said burglary left him vulnerable and caused considerable harm. Written by Adam Smith. A burglar who stole a Rowley Regis amputee's specially adapted wheelchair and mobility vehicle has avoided jail. Jaden Davis, 19, and two friends donned balaclavas and went on a mini crime spree in Rowley Regis on May 24th last year. Scoping out each home on Bill Thomas Way, the trio tried several cars to see if they were unlocked, until they found one, and stole a pair of expensive sunglasses before throwing the contents of a handbag on the floor. Unimpressed with their night's work, they broke into a family home and stole the car from the driveway, with the owner's specially equipped wheelchair in the boot. However, a tracker on the vehicle meant West Midlands police could locate the vehicle, and Davis was arrested a week later after the forensics team found a particular fingerprint on the wheelchair. Davis, of Hales Owen Road, pleaded guilty to 2 counts of theft, sunglasses and a car, and burglary. He was sentenced at Wolverhampton Crown Court. Prosecutor Stephen Churchill said, the defendant and 2 accused were walking through Bill Thomas Way in the early hours of a night in May last year. All were wearing balaclavas. They would stop at a property and try to open the car doors of any vehicles on driveways. They succeeded with 1 car and stole Ray-Ban sunglasses worth £140. When they passed 1 property, they went up the driveway and they gained entry into the car and stole sunglasses. They dumped a bag on the floor after finding it empty. That was around 2:30 a.m. They then targeted another property where a family with a 12-year-old girl was inside. Her mother heard a noise outside and went downstairs. She noticed a window was opened, which normally would be closed. She looked out the window and realised a vehicle was stolen. The father is an amputee, and his £4,000 specially fitted wheelchair was in the back of the car, which the defendant stole, leaving the man unable to live independently until it was returned. In a victim personal statement, the man Davies burgled said, "Due to being disabled, I felt very vulnerable. Having my wheelchair and car stolen caused me considerable harm." Davies had no previous convictions, but in mitigation, the court heard Davies had pleaded guilty and was remorseful for his actions. Recorder Geoffrey Kelly, KC, sentenced Davies to 16 months in prison, suspended for 2 years, 15 days of rehabilitation activity, and 150 hours unpaid work in the community. He said, "In the early hours of May 29 last year, you and two friends decided to dress in a way which would hide your identity, including hoods and balaclavas. You then went to a residential development and went on a crime spree. You gained entry to a property of a family whose vulnerable child was asleep." He added, "Imagine what your mother would think if a stranger went into her home in the early hours. While the family were petrified, were absolutely petrified, knowing there were strangers in their house where their vulnerable child was sleeping." Trustees' notices. The West Bromwich Building Society Staff Retirement Scheme. Notice to creditors and beneficiaries under Section 27 of the Trustee Act 1925. Notice is hereby given pursuant to Section 27 of the Trustee Act 1925 that the trustees of the West Bromwich Building Society Staff Retirement Scheme, otherwise known as the Scheme, are winding up the scheme. The wind-up of the scheme commenced on 20th of August 2025. Any creditor, member or beneficiary of the scheme, or any other person who believes they have a claim against or interest in the scheme, is required to write to the trustees at the address below by 7th of November 2025 in order to make a claim. This may include employees or former employees of West Bromwich Building Society or West Bromwich Mortgage Company Limited or their survivors. The contact details are as follows. The trustees of the West Bromwich Building Society Staff Retirement Scheme, C/O, Lane Clark and Peacock LLP, St Paul's House, St Paul's Hill, Winchester, Hampshire, SO225AB. The email address is westbromadmin@lcp.uk.com and the West Brom Admin is a capital W, capital B and a capital A. And the telephone number is 01962 454 623. Claimants' particulars should include their full name, address, date of birth and details of the period of employment to which their claim relates. After the 7th of November 2025, the trustees will proceed to wind up the scheme and secure benefits for any remaining beneficiaries, having regard only to the claims and interests of which they have prior notice. The trustees shall not be liable to any person of whose claims and demands they have not had notice. Any person who has been contacted by the trustees at their current address or has already made a claim and received a response need not reapply to the trustees. This was issued on behalf of the trustees of the West Bromwich Building Society Staff Retirement Scheme, dated September 5th, 2025.
Hello, this is Subject with your news from the Express and Star. Saturday, the 6th of September, body care branches close immediately. Three West Midlands stores have closed after cosmetics firm Body Care slid into administration. Some 450 jobs have been lost across the country as the ailing firm confirmed it had gone into administration yesterday, closing 32 of its 147 stores, including branches in Cannock, Stourbridge and West Bromwich. Arrests of men over suspected terror plot. Four men have been arrested on suspicion of plotting acts of terrorism in raids including in the Black Country, as well as Yorkshire and Derbyshire. Counter-Terrorism Policing North East, known as CTPNE, said a 49-year-old man was arrested in West Bromwich during a coordinated police operation. A 33-year-old was also arrested in Leeds, a 31-year-old arrested in Huddersfield, and a 34-year-old man held in Derby. Detectives say all four were arrested on Friday as part of a nationwide investigation. They were held on suspicion of being concerned in the commission, preparation, or instigation of acts of terrorism under Section 41 of the Terrorism Act 2000. A CTPNE spokeswoman said the arrests are part of an active investigation, but that no imminent threat was apparent. She added, "The men have all been taken to a local police station for questioning. Searches are ongoing at a number of properties in relation to this investigation. This activity was pre-planned and intelligence-led. There is not believed to be any imminent threat to the public in the UK linked to this investigation." Books. Medical school gave me a new murder story idea. Doctor turned author Kay talks of life and a new book. There is a picture of former doctor Adam Kay and his new book. A hospital is a perfect setting for a murder, agrees former junior doctor Adam Kay, author of This Is Going to Hurt, the best-selling memoir which was turned into a TV adaptation starring Ben Whishaw. I can't be the only person who at medical school was thinking, "Oh, if I was a murderer, that would be a good way to do it," quips the 45-year-old former doctor turned comedian and writer. He's now written his debut novel, A Particularly Nasty Case, a funny, acerbic and twisty crime caper with rude bits and quite a lot of swearing. It opens in a gay sauna, so it can't be cosy crime. It's funny crime, he muses, when asked if he's joining the genre spearheaded by Richard Osman and the Rev. Richard Coles. "I'm honoured to share a shelf with any crime writer called Richard," he says wryly, "but I don't think anyone ever makes any noise by trying to cover old ground. I like the idea that I found my own version. Certainly, if it can sit on the bestseller lists with the Richards, I am very happy." The drama begins when a toxic hospital consultant dies suddenly of a suspected heart attack. Fellow doctor, consultant rheumatologist Eaton Rose, isn't convinced, and when another senior doctor dies in similar circumstances, he sets out to prove that there's more to these deaths that meets the eye. There's a side order of romance with a hospital porter called Cole, who helps Rose in his search for the truth. But there's more to this first novel than just an uproarious murder mystery. Kay has long been banging the drum for better provision of mental health care for doctors. So, unsurprisingly, his protagonist suffers from bipolar disorder and is returning to work following the death of a patient in his care, which led to a breakdown. Kay, too, has suffered both professional and personal trauma. When he left the medical profession in 2010, where he was a junior doctor in obstetrics and gynaecology, he suffered nightmares and PTSD and didn't seek counselling until 7 years later, after This Is Going to Hurt was published. He continues, "I'm no poster boy for looking after one's own mental health, but the biggest thing I've done was getting help and talking about it." Since This Is Going to Hurt was published in 2017, Kay has penned a second autobiography, undoctored, and extended his writing to children's books, both fact and fiction, all of which have been bestsellers, as well as the award-winning TV adaptation of This Is Going to Hurt, and sell-out one-man tours. Doing his comedy shows and talking about his life as a junior doctor helped his mental health, he adds, plus the counselling which he still has. "The other thing I've done is now I have a work-life balance," he says, somewhat ironically, as he has two two-and-a-half-year-old toddlers, Ruby and Ziggy, with husband producer James Farrell, a burgeoning book career, and various tour commitments. Having two toddlers has upended the equilibrium, but the difference now is that if I'm working too much, it's my fault. I now can say, I'm really sorry, Mr. Production Company, or Mrs. Publisher, or whoever, that I can't. Keen to spread the mental health message in the book, he has drawn on some of his own research. I've done a lot of work in the space of mental illness among healthcare staff, and there are numerous people I've spoken to who have experienced the deep stigma of being a doctor with mental illness. That's something I really wanted to dig into. I firmly believe that the NHS is our greatest institution, but at the same time, one of our worst employers. He has met numerous health ministers over the years to raise the issues. Every time there's a discussion about the NHS workforce, why aren't there enough people? Why is everyone going? No one digs into the fact that, paradoxical as it is, in an environment where everyone is caring, there isn't a lot of care for the staff who work there. Things are getting better, but the NHS is still a decade behind the rest of society in the way it thinks it is appropriate to look after its staff. Books aside, he will continue to put pressure on the NHS in any way he can to improve the lot of NHS workers. My particular drum is one about mental health for NHS staff, and that is something that successive health secretaries of different coloured rosettes have taken seriously, for which I'm genuinely grateful. Is the Labour government making a difference? I was hugely excited about what the change of regime would mean for our NHS. I've been underwhelmed by the lack of palpable difference in terms of what that's actually translated to. This latest 10-year-old plan doesn't look much different to previous 10-year plans. He's currently working on the second book featuring Eaton Rose and hopes there will always be a message behind the funny stories. A Particularly Nasty Case by Adam Kay is published by Orion, priced £20. NHS support staff in threat to take action. The health service could be hit by strikes in the autumn unless plans that could see thousands of workers transferred out of the NHS are halted, a union has warned. Unison told ministers there will be no place to hide if they do not clamp down on NHS trusts farming out support services to subsidiary companies. The union has tabled a motion on the issue to be debated at the TUC Congress, which opens in Brighton on Sunday. Unison said proposals by health trusts for more outsourcing are a direct contradiction of Labour's pre-election pledge to bring privatised public services back in-house. The union is warning that unless ministers act, there could be strike action in the autumn. Unison General Secretary Christina McAnear said, before the election, Labour promised to bring workers on private contracts back into public services, but in power, ministers are doing the opposite. The government can't hide behind NHS England. These decisions are being taken on this government's watch. The NHS needs to be rebuilt, not dismantled, and parcelled off to the lowest bidder. The NHS depends on support staff. Many are already low paid, and farming them off to subsidiary companies will leave them with an even worse deal.
Hello, this is Jenny. It's nice to be back after the summer break. I hope this finds you all well. Troubling new figures reveal student absence from schools. A record level of pupils were severely absent from schools in the West Midlands in autumn last year, new figures show. School unions have warned fining parents is a crude tool, calling for better support for schools and families to address the root cause of pupils missing out on education. Figures from the Department for Education show 1,005 pupils in Walsall were severely absent, meaning they missed at least half of school sessions in the 2024-25 autumn term. They accounted for 2.3% of pupils, the highest since comparable records began in 2016-17. Meanwhile, 21% of pupils in the area were persistently absent, missing 10% or more of sessions. In Wolverhampton, 7,688 pupils were found to be persistently absent, meaning they missed 10% or more school sessions in the 2024-25 autumn term. They accounted for 18% of pupils in the area, down from 19% the year before. Meanwhile, 2% in the area were severely absent, missing 50% or more of sessions. A record 979 pupils in Dudley were severely absent, accounting for 2.3% in the area, while 20.8% were persistently absent. Sandwell also saw a record 1,072 pupils severely absent, making up 2% of the pupils, and 19.9% were persistently absent. In Staffordshire, 1 in 6 pupils were considered persistently absent, a shocking total of 17,936 children. Across England, the proportion also reached a record high at 2% of students. Yet, the rate of persistently absent pupils fell from 19.4% in autumn 2023-24 to 17.8% last year. Margaret Mulholland, SEND and Inclusion Specialist at the Association of School and College Leaders, said, "It is troubling that, even as absence rates are coming down overall, the percentage of pupils missing at least 50% of their education is rising. We need to focus on helping these pupils overcome the barriers preventing them from being in school on a regular basis." Beth Prescott, Education Lead at the Centre for Social Justice, said, "5 years on from school closures, classroom absences can no longer be viewed as a post-pandemic blip. The material risk now is that this issue is becoming deeply entrenched. I deal a lot with school absence in work, and it's a really tricky one. Getting children back into school when they've been absent for a period of time is really difficult, and I do agree that there needs to be more support for schools, but also for families, because fining people is not solving the root cause of the issue." 4 people escaped unharmed after house wrecked by blaze. Shocked neighbours expressed their relief after hearing shouts and seeing flames. An article by Adam Smith. Neighbours awoken by shouts, sirens and fire engines attending a house fire in Bearwood have spoken of their relief they are not mourning a death today. 6 fire engines attended the blaze in Dunsford Road yesterday morning, with the first arriving 5 minutes after the first 999 call was received at 7:35 a.m. Firefighters said they led 4 people to safety after they had got out of the house as the fire took hold. A West Midlands Fire Service spokesman told the Express and Star, "We led 4 people to safety who had been in the property, but had exited by the time we got there. No one was injured." West Midlands Fire Service posted on social media, "This morning we attended a house fire in Smethwick, where 6 fire engines were called to the scene. The first fire engine was in attendance in less than 5 minutes. Now, shocked residents who called 999 after being awoken by shouts and seeing flames shooting out of a bedroom window have told of their relief that no one was injured. 4 occupants of the property, which is now gutted and the subject of a fire service forensic investigation, were led to safety by first responders after escaping the blaze without serious injury." Dunsford Road resident Asher Bosher said, "When I opened my door this morning, there were fire engines and ambulances everywhere. The house was wrecked by fire. I first thought someone must have died, but I saw the ambulance people caring for a man and a child. None of them were seriously injured. We are just glad no one was killed today." He added, "We still don't know what happened or why the fire started." Father of 3, Mohammed Khan, praised the fire service for getting to the fire so quickly. He said, "The houses are all attached to each other or really close to each other on these streets. So if the firemen had not got here so quickly, it could have easily have spread to the houses on either side. My wife's friend phoned 999 when she saw flames coming out of the bedroom window. The fire service were here within minutes and were running into the house. They seemed to put it out really quickly. It was great to see the people from the house walking about outside because we were all worried they were stuck inside the fire. Fire crews were still outside the property at 2 p.m. yesterday, with the road closed to through traffic. West Midlands police tape was stretched across either side of the house, which had scaffolding outside and showed the scars of a blaze with the bedroom totally gutted and scorched with fire. National Grid and Ducey groundwork teams, including a mini digger, were outside the property until the early afternoon. West Midlands Police said they were aware of the fire, but it was being dealt with by the West Midlands Fire Service and was not a police matter. More government posts to move into city base after expansion revealed. More government jobs could be set to move to Wolverhampton after it was revealed the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government was expanding its office space in the city. The department, which until last week was headed by Angela Rayner, had a base in the I-19 building close to Wolverhampton bus station. In May this year, Mrs. Rayner came under fire from the city's Conservative group after it emerged that she had never visited the office in Railway Drive since taking office the previous July. However, this week, the council's cabinet revealed that an agreement had been struck to move the local government pension scheme's central office from I-9 to the neighbouring I-10 building, creating space for the ministry to expand. Conservative group leader, Councillor Simon Bennett, who had led criticism of Mrs. Rayner for her non-attendance, welcomed the news. This is something which has been called on by the Conservatives for months, and was one of the only things she did in power which was welcome. The group repeatedly called on her to show leadership and make proper use of the office, and calling on her publicly in meetings, urging her to bring more of her department staff into the city to support jobs, growth and confidence in Wolverhampton's economy. Angela Rayner's departure only underlines what has been clear for some time. She treated her office in Wolverhampton as nothing more than an afterthought. The people of this city deserve better. That is why I am pleased to see progress finally being made. This step will secure jobs, bring more investment and show Wolverhampton has an important role to play in the work of the government. More time to question four terror suspects. Police have extra time to question four men arrested on suspicion of plotting acts of terrorism, including one man from West Bromwich. Counter-terrorism policing North East said on Friday a 33-year-old was held in Leeds, a 31-year-old was arrested in Huddersfield, a man, 34, was held in Derby, and a man, 49, was arrested in West Bromwich. All were arrested on suspicion of being concerned in the commission, preparation or instigation of acts of terrorism. Three teens face theft allegation. Three teenagers have been arrested after a suspected stolen vehicle failed to stop for police officers in Cradley Heath. West Midlands Police said the officers saw the vehicle being driven at high speeds in the early hours of Thursday. But when they tried to pull it over, the driver did not stop. When the vehicle eventually came to a stop in Meadow Walk, all the occupants fled from the scene. However, following a foot chase, they were detained. Following checks, it is believed the vehicle was stolen and it was seized for further examination. A quantity of nitrous oxide canisters were also seized at the scene. Three teenage boys aged 17 from Cradley Heath were arrested on suspicion of theft of motor vehicle and possession of drugs with intent to supply. They have been given bail pending further police inquiries.
This is Kate and I'll be reading you some articles from the Express and Star the 9th of September. Charitable Foundation boosts theatres travel fund for schools. The Richardson Brothers Foundation is backing the Wolverhampton Grand Theatre for the second year running, providing schools with free coach travel to the theatre. The scheme offers eligible Dudley, Samwell, Walsall and Wolverhampton schools free travel to shows until August 2026. The Travel Fund was created last year to help educational establishments who are finding it difficult to fund extracurricular visits. It also backs the Theatre for Every Child campaign, supporting the right for every child to enjoy and experience the theatre. The Richardson business was founded more than 70 years ago in the Black Country and has grown into a successful international investment company. Jan Jennings, on behalf of the Richardson Brother Foundation, said that the scheme aims to help children and young people in the Black Country to enjoy the magic of theatre. And she added, "We're excited to continue this important initiative." To apply, email Nadia, which is N-A-D-I-A, dot A-B-D-E-L-A-A-L at grandtheatre, or one word, .co.uk. And this article is supported by a photograph of Jan Jennings on behalf of the Richardson Brothers Foundation with Nadia and some young theatregoers. And they're standing outside the entrance of the Grand Theatre with their arms in the air. Three-stripe burglar found hiding in a loft, sent back to prison. A three-stripe burglar from Wensbury is sent back to prison after breaking into two Dudley homes. Shane Lewis, 33, was caught stealing a bank card, car keys and a passport while on bail for another burglary where the police found him hiding in the loft of a Dudley property. Lewis of Corporation Street, Wensbury, pleaded guilty at Wolverhampton Crown Court on Friday of two counts of burglary, two counts of fraud and failing to surrender whilst on bail. Peter Grice, prosecuting, said, "At 9:25 a.m. on January the 29th this year, a member of the public spotted two men acting suspiciously on the parade in Dudley. Both were wearing masks and one was holding a screwdriver with the other a crowbar. The member of the public heard the sound of them breaking in and phoned the police. Officers attended within minutes and gained entry to the property where they found the pair hiding in the loft. They were arrested and the defendant was meant to stand trial in July, but he did not turn up for that. And whilst on bail on Sunday, July the 6th, the defendant and another man entered a room in a HMO and stole a passport, car keys and a bank card. The following day, he tried to use the bank card at Dixon's Green service station, first to purchase goods for £55.39.99. This was captured on CCTV and the defendant was arrested a few days later. Lewis has 28 convictions for 56 offences and is a three-strike burglar. Justice Michael Chambers, KC, sentenced Lewis to 2 years and 4 months. He said, "I'm sentencing you for the two separate burglaries. You have a very bad record of dishonesty. You're a three-strike burglar. You would have known that you were at risk of being given a minimum term in January when you committed your first burglary. The second burglary was committed whilst you were on bail for the first." He added, "In June 2021, you were convicted of a number of house burglaries and you were classified as a three-strike offender. A burglary is an intrusion into someone's home, not just the financial loss. I'm giving you a credit for guilty pleas and I'm not sentencing you for the fraud or for the not surrendering of bail." Depot plan to shake up buses. Buying sites is part of strategy to bring region's network under public control. A major overhaul of the West Midlands bus network is set to move a step closer with the purchase of depots across the region. Members of the West Midlands Combined Authority, WMCA, board are meeting this week to discuss the depot acquisition. The costs of acquiring bus depots will be discussed in private, but a report to the board said that the business case showed a positive cost to benefit ratio for progressing the plans. The strategy is part of the West Midlands Mayor Richard Parker's bid to bring buses back under public control through a financing model. Mr. Parker has said the existing bus network is failing and said franchising would give people greater control over fares, timetables and routes. Owning bus depots is seen as a key component of franchising, which Boss is saying it will help increase competition in a market dominated by one operator. WMCA already own the Warsaw Depot in Carl Street. Others listed for purchase include Wolverhampton Depot in Park Lane, Pensnet Depot in Second Avenue, West Bromwich Depot in Oak Lane and Birmingham Central Depot in Liverpool Street. Holiday is a top priority when it comes to splashing out. A trip away comes above spending on clothes, eating and drinking out, or leisure. Holidays are a top spending priority when it comes to splashing discretionary cash. Ahead of dining out and home reservations, a survey has indicated. Although many people have just settled back into their back-to-school routine, another holiday could just be around the corner for some, research suggests. Nearly half of people surveyed voted holidays a top spending priority ahead of spending on clothes, shoes and accessories, eating and drinking out, home and garden renovations and leisure activities. People are able to choose up to three spending priorities in the research. The survey commissioned by the travel councillors found even those surveyed who sees themselves as disciplined savers and rarely treat themselves see holidays as a priority, with almost two-fifths agreeing. When asked about the broader financial goals, nearly a quarter of people surveyed said their top ambition would be to have enough cash to travel the world, while just 7% cited major lifestyle milestones, such as a wedding. Nearly three quarters of people surveyed had taken a holiday in the past 12 months. About a third of holidaymakers surveyed estimated that they will spend more on holidays this year than last. And with 56% planning to spend around the same and 9% looking to cut back. While people typically spent between £500 and £1 and £1,000 on a single holiday booking in the last year, those earning over £120,000 spent £9,501 to £10,000 on a single trip. The research also found the most popular holiday luxuries that people enjoy are local shopping and buying souvenirs, luxury accommodation, drinks at scenic views or rooftop bars, and treating themselves to meals at high-end or famous restaurants. Morrison's cutting price of 650 grocery items. Morrison's has cut the price of about 650 everyday essentials as part of its battle for customers. Items such as chicken breast fillets, laundry pods, vegetables and enchilada kits are included and have had their prices reduced by an average of 18%, and it will remain on promotion for 4 to 8 weeks, Morrison said. The cut aims to help make household budgets go further ahead of Christmas, the supermarkets added. It comes as analysis from the Office for National Statistics, the ONS, found that the country's lowest earning households saw their cost of living rise by 4.1% between April and June. This compares with the 3.8% rise in the living costs of the highest earning households. The ONS has overall UK household costs rose by 3.9% in the year to June, surging from 2.7% in the year to March. The price change will be available both in store and online. Alex Paver, Pricing and Customer Director at Morrison's, said, "We know that the cost of everyday products really matters to our customers right now. And that's why we're cutting the prices of over 650 items, from fresh favourites to cupboard staples, so that our customers can trust they're getting real value when they shop." And this article is also supported by a photograph of staff member Fasani, and she has a trolley full of cut price goods.
Welcome back to the Express and Star Pub Quiz. And this week's round, it's The Price is Right. Question 1. Who first hosted the UK version of the TV game show The Price is Right? Question 2. Which horror actor provided the spoken word narration for the Michael Jackson hit Thriller? Question 3. Who recorded a cover of the Everly Brothers' The Price of Love in 1976? Question 4. Fanny Price is a protagonist in which Jane Austen novel? Question 5. Who presents the reality TV series The Price of Perfection? Question 6. Dilly's Price runs the grocers in which fictional village? Question 7. Gerwin Price is a world champion at which sport? Question 8. Record shop Our Price closed its final store in which year? Question 9. At which weight did boxer Lauren Price win an Olympic gold medal in Tokyo? And question 10. Best known for works including Strangers on a Train and The Talented Mr. Ripley, who wrote the romance novel The Price of Salt? How's your The Price is Right knowledge? Click to the answers to find out. Here are the answers for The Price is Right round. Question 1. Who first hosted the UK version of the TV game show The Price is Right? Leslie Crowther. Question 2. Which horror actor provided the spoken word narration for the Michael Jackson hit Thriller? Vincent Price. Question 3. Who recorded a cover of the Everly Brothers' The Price of Love in 1976? Brian Ferry. Question 4. Fanny Price is a protagonist in which Jane Austen novel? Mansfield Park. Question 5. Who presents the reality TV series The Price of Perfection? Olivia Attwood. Question 6. Dilly's Price runs the grocers in which fictional village? Pontypandy. Question 7. Gerwin Price is a world champion at which sport? Darts. Question 8. Record shop Our Price closed its final store in which year? 2004. Question 9. At which weight did boxer Lauren Price win an Olympic gold medal in Tokyo? Middleweight. And question 10. Best known for works including Strangers on a Train and The Talented Mr. Ripley, who wrote the romance novel The Price of Salt? Patricia Highsmith. Thanks for joining me in this week's quiz. I'm Sarah Ann, and I'll be back next time. Bye!
Sandwell to introduce changes to bin collections from the 15th of September. From the 15th of September, Sandwell Council will introduce changes to bin collections to improve recycling quality and meet new government regulations. The Council is introducing alternate weekly collections, AWC, for bins and a new dual-stream recycling system, DSR, to meet new UK government simpler recycling regulations, which will help improve recycling rates, reduce contamination and disposal costs, freeing up funds for other vital services. The new system, which begins from the 15th of September 2025, will see residents separating their paper, cardboard and cartons from other recyclable materials. To support the changes, residents will receive a new recycling blue bag, which will be delivered to all households between the 26th of August and the 14th of September. These bags are for paper, cardboard and cartons only. Other recyclable materials like plastic bottles, tubs, cans and glass bottles and jars should continue to go in the usual recycling, blue lid bin. Flats and high-rise properties will not be affected at this stage. We will be rolling out these new services as part of Phase 2 in 2026. The switch to alternate weekly collections, AWC, means each household will still receive a weekly bin collection. However, collections will alternate between your recycling and non-recycling containers. One week we will collect recycling and next week we will collect non-recycling waste, or vice versa. During the first week of the changes, some households will have a recycling collection and others will have a non-recycling waste collection. As a result, some residents' day of collection will also change. A calendar explaining which bin you need to put out on what day will be distributed nearer the time. These collection changes aim to reduce the amount of waste sent for incineration and ensure we are recycling all that we can. The new dual-stream system DSR is part of Sandwell's commitment to reduce reuse and recycle waste. The aim is to improve the quality of recycling, ensuring more materials stay in use for longer and reducing environmental impact. Councillor Keith Alcock, Sandwell Council's Cabinet Member for Environment and Highways, said, "We all have a part to play in tackling climate change and reducing waste. These changes will help us recycle more and waste less. Separating paper and card from other recyclables improves quality and helps us meet new government legislation. I encourage all residents to take a moment to understand the changes and do their bit. Together, we can make Sandwell cleaner and greener." Tony Marston, Serco Senior Contract Manager, said, "We are committed to providing a smooth and successful service change for residents and are proud to support Sandwell Council with their sustainability goals. Food waste collections will remain weekly, and residents can sign up for free to receive food waste collections. Garden waste will be collected fortnightly, which is available for a £40 annual subscription in 2025. Visit www.sandwell.gov.uk/bins to register and find out more. To help residents prepare for the changes, we will be sending detailed information directly to households before the changes come into effect. We'll also be sharing updates and helpful reminders on our social media channels and encourage everyone to sign up for email alerts to stay informed. We're asking residents to think about what they recycle and how they do it. Please help us by making sure your recycling is clean and dry. If an item can't be recycled, think about if it can be reused, mended, or donated. Making sure you are putting the right items in the right bins. Further information about the changes and to read our frequently asked questions, visit sandwell.gov.uk/bins together. We can build a cleaner, more sustainable Sandwell.
When you asked to receive recordings produced by the Sandwell Talking News, you gave your name and address so that we could send you our memory sticks or CDs. This information is stored in a secure database, and address labels are also stored in a secure location. Having left our premises, the address labels and postal wallets are then under the protection and care of Royal Mail. Your contact details are only used for sending you our memory sticks or CDs, and will never be forwarded to a third party. If you ask us to stop sending Sandwell Talking News to you, your contact details will be deleted from our database and your address labels will be permanently destroyed. We promise and assure you that we take data protection seriously and make every effort to meet the requirements of the Data Protection Act. If your circumstances do change, you move home, change your phone number, or wish to unsubscribe to the Sandwell Talking News, please call the office on 0121 525 4810 or email sandwelltn@gmail.com so that we can make the necessary changes.
Some audio described TV programmes for the next week along with radio programme highlights from Talking News Federation. Search for publications TNF Soundings to hear these directly on their website.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, this is Wharfdale Talking News with a selection of audio described TV programmes from the main channels starting Saturday the 13th of September until Friday the 19th of September. This selection was compiled and is being read by me, Glenys. Saturday the 13th of September, BBC One. At 2:45pm we have Escaped the Country, where a couple look to escape to Cornwall with their young daughter. Followed at 3:10pm by a film, Early Man. A Stone Age tribe take on a bronze mining bully by learning to play football. And at 8:10pm, there's Casualty. The ED staff have to remain professional as they treat a divisive figure. BBC Two. Children's programmes start at 6:10am with Hey Dougie, followed at 6:20 by Mojo Swap Shops. At 6:30, there is Grizzly and the Lemmings. And at 7, there's Pokemon Horizons. At 7:35, there's Gladiators, Epic Pranks, with pranks at a kid's birthday party and behind the scenes at Sheffield Arena. On ITV, at 6 o'clock in the morning, there's Simply Raymond Blanc. Raymond cooks braised beef in red wine and his summer fruit soup. At 7:30 a.m., Cooking with the Stars. The three remaining stars battle it out in the grand finale to find out who will be crowned champion. At 4:40 p.m., there's the film Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, a fantasy film starring Daniel Radcliffe. A young boy learns that he is the orphan son of powerful wizards. At 8:30 p.m., You Bet is on tour, with ordinary people facing extraordinary challenges while being bet on by a celebrity panel. At 9:35, it's Clarkson on TV. This episode covers pubes, garden makeovers and Cornwall, as Jeremy also takes a close look at Matt Hancock's trousers and reveals his ultimate royal crush. At 10:30 p.m, the drama series One Night continues, with Hat beginning her own investigation and realising that the police are hiding something. Channel 4. At 7:55 a.m, there are two episodes of Everybody Loves Raymond, followed at 5 to 9 by two episodes of Frasier, and at 5 to 10 by two episodes of The Simpsons. At 12:55 p.m, there's George Clark's Amazing Spaces, which sees George transforming a rusty lift into a cabin in the sky and heading to Denmark to visit a modern Viking longhouse. Plus, the pinkest thing ever to appear on this show. At 3 p.m, Kirsty and Phil's Love It or List It. Kirsty revisits a couple in Newcastle who had jumped ship on their battleground of a renovation. At 4 p.m, Worst House on the Street has two mates buying a rundown house in Coventry together and wanting to turn it into a home. At 5:35 p.m, there's the film Star Trek. A vengeful time traveller targets Kirk and Spock on their first mission. At 8 p.m, there's episode one of a new series, Britain's Railway Empire in Colour, marking the railway's 200th birthday and revealing how Britain gave trains to the world. At 9 o'clock, there's the film The Pope's Exorcist, a supernatural horror starring Russell Crowe with a demonic possession in Spain connecting to dark secrets from the Inquisition. At 11 p.m, there's the film The Last Stand, a thriller starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, where a small-town sheriff and his inexperienced staff take on a drug cartel boss. Sunday, 14th of September. At 2:45 p.m, escape to the country, with a couple from South London searching for their dream home in Devon. At 8:15 p.m, Freddie Flintoff's Field of Dreams. Freddie adds a third team to his league. At 9:15 p.m, the fifth of eight episodes of King and Conqueror. Harold and Edith risk their lives to bargain with William, but get a guarded reception. BBC Two, 5:15 p.m, The Great British Sewing Bee. It's the semi-final, with three challengers standing between the sewers and the final. This is a repeat from the programme last Tuesday. At 7 p.m, Saving Lives at Sea rescues six teenagers cut off by the tide in Watergate Bay, North Cornwall. At 8 p.m, there's Living Next Door to Putin. Katia Adler explores how life is changing for people living on Russia's border. At 9 p.m, Rob and Ryland's Passage to India. The pair discover a tomb with a view, encounter a billionaire art collector, attempt their own rap performance, and try the ancient art of puppetry. At 10 p.m, there's the film Tar. The life of celebrated conductor Lydia Tarr begins to unravel when allegations about her personal and professional relationships begin to appear in the media. ITV. At 6 a.m, there's Simply Raymond Blanc. Raymond makes homemade garlic bread and a tasty salad. At 10:30 a.m, In for a Penny. Stephen Mulhern is in Walt Disney World Resort in Florida with classic and brand new games. At 5:30 p.m., You Bet on tour. ordinary people facing extraordinary challenges while being bet on by a celebrity panel. At 8 p.m, Beat the Chasers. More people from across the country look to win big. At 9 p.m, Cold Water, the first episode of a dark-humoured thriller series. After failing to intervene in a violent incident, a man moves his family to an idyllic area where neighbours harbour a secret. At 10:20 p.m, Jack Reacher, a mystery action thriller starring Tom Cruise and Rosamund Pike. Only one man has the skills to take out a deadly sniper. Channel 4. From 8:05 in the morning, two episodes of Everybody Loves Raymond, followed at 9 by two episodes of Frasier, and from 1 p.m, there are three episodes of The Simpsons. At 5:30 p.m, The Great British Bake Off and It's Biscuit Week, and the bakers make hobnobs and memento time capsules. 7 p.m, Inside McVitie's, a special look behind the scenes at one of the nation's favourite biscuit manufacturers. At 8 p.m, Educating Yorkshire. Year 10 Scott's behaviour put his international rugby dreams at risk. And as model student Alexa piles on the pressure to ace Year 10, her anxiety becomes overwhelming. At 9 p.m, there's episode 7 of The Inheritance. As the game intensifies, how far will the players go to protect themselves? At 10 p.m, Gogglebox. What do Britain's sharpest armchair critics think of the biggest and best shows on TV this week? At 11 p.m, My Massive Cock. Being plus size down there seriously complicates some men's lives and relationships, and penis reduction surgery can seem like the only answer. And now on to Monday and programmes shown at the same time. On BBC One at 10:45, The Moment of Proof. At 12:15, Bargain Hunt, not Monday or Tuesday. At 7:30 p.m, EastEnders. On BBC Two at 6:30 p.m, there's The Great Railway Coastal Journeys with Michael Portillo, not on Friday. On ITV at 2 p.m, there's Dickinson's Real Deal, covering the country finding treasures. At 7:30 p.m, Emmerdale. And at 8 p.m, Coronation Street, not on Thursday. Channel 4. From 6:30 a.m. are three episodes of The King of Queens, followed at 7:45 a.m. by three episodes of Everybody Loves Raymond. And from 9:10 a.m, four episodes of Frasier. At 1:10 p.m, Car SOS, with Tim and Fuzz travelling around the country fixing classic cars. Monday the 15th of September, BBC One, 11:15 a.m, Homes Under the Hammer, auctions and renovations from across the country. At 9 p.m, there's the third episode of The Guest, where unsettling revelations about Fran come to light. And at 10:40 p.m, two episodes of Trying, a couple, unable to conceive naturally, try adoption. BBC Two. At 9 p.m, we have a documentary about Twiggy, the iconic 60s model. ITV One. At 9 p.m, episode 2 of Cold Water. John struggles to cope with his guilt as Tommy's influence on him grows. At 11:40 p.m, Heathrow, Britain's busiest airport. This episode follows Joel, the manager of Heathrow's testing centre. On Channel 4, at 8 p.m, there's Jamie, Eat Yourself Healthy, celebrating heart health promoting ingredients. At 9 p.m, The Inheritance. After last night's fallouts, the players go on a bear hunt, but there's a twist in store. At 10 p.m, First Dates. Nice guy Mateo meets goal-oriented Sam. A tree hugger, a chef, and a wedding singer also seek their matches. At 11:05, Educating Yorkshire. Year 10 Scots finds his dreams of rugby stardom in jeopardy, and a classmate fears being dropped down a set. Tuesday, 16th of September, BBC One. At 8 p.m, Stacey and Joe. Stacey and Joe trade school runs for ski runs, but Joe's romantic surprise quickly melts into laughter. At 9 p.m, The Great British Sewing Bee, the final. After challenges including the bias-cut dress, sheer fabrics and trompe d'oeil, one sewer will be crowned winner. At 11:55 p.m, Stranded on Honeymoon Island. A crate containing the couple's mobile phones washes ashore, revealing more than anybody had bargained for. David causes shockwaves at Couples Cove. BBC Two. At 8 a.m, The Repair Shop, where the team take on four more precious items, including a diary from Nazi-occupied Guernsey, a rusted station lamp, and a beloved 1980s doll's house. 4:15 p.m, Cornwall. This fishing life. Newlyn, Cornwall's fishing capital, prepares for the challenges and opportunities Brexit may bring. At 8 p.m, Michael Portillo's 200 Years of Railways. Michael marks the moment Britain's modern railway was born. At 11 p.m, Rob and Ryland's passage to India. In Delhi, Rob and Ryland follow in the footsteps of E.M. Forster to discover one of the world's oldest civilizations. ITV. At 8 p.m, Midsummer's Murder. Dressed to Kill. Drag queens are ostracised when their charity event clashes with the annual domino competition. 10:45 p.m, The Hitman's Bodyguard. An action crime comedy film starring Ryan Reynolds and Samuel L. Jackson. A bodyguard is given the task of getting Hitman to trial. Channel 4, 8 p.m, The Great British Bake Off. It's Bread Week, and the bread makers make monkey bread, a fast food and a sweet bread showstopper. Who'll rise to the top and who needs to dust themselves off? 9:30 p.m, The Inheritance. A devious game with Elizabeth Hurley and Rob Reiner. The players face the ultimate test in the Mirrored Garden. At 10:30 p.m, there's Celebrity Gogglebox, a collection of the best bits of assorted famous faces. And at 11:35 p.m, Gogglebox, the brand new series, continues. Wednesday, 17th of September, BBC One. At 8 p.m, there's MasterChef, the semi-finals celebrating Jane Austen's birthday by cooking a meal for 80 members of the Jane Austen Society at the last house Jane lived in at Chawton, Hampshire. At 9 p.m, Stranded on Honeymoon Island. After the film festival, the couples split into two groups for separate island getaways, unaware that the castaways are planning to crash the party. BBC Two, at 7:30 p.m, Grand Tours of Scotland's Rivers sees Paul Merton exploring the River Irvine in Ayrshire. At 8 p.m, Digging for Britain has Alice Roberts reporting from a Roman mosaic excavation in Rutland and in Hull on fortifications built by Henry VIII. At 9, there's Wilderness with Simon Reeve, where he travels through Patagonia from the ice field in the south to searching for gauchos on the prairies. At 10, there's a new three-part documentary, Missing in Paradise, where the team explore the disappearance of Sam Heslop from a luxury yacht in the Caribbean. And the evening on BBC Two rounds off with a documentary about Twiggy, the iconic swinging 60s model. ITV. At 9 p.m, there's Madeleine McCann. 18 years after the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, a criminologist returns to Portugal to re-examine the evidence against the prime suspect. At 10:45, there's the film Jack Reacher, an action crime thriller with Jack investigating the gunning down of five innocent people in Pittsburgh. Channel 4. At 8 p.m, on Location, 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 Kirsty and Phil help couples in Buckinghamshire and around Marlow find their dream homes within their budgets. At 9, there's episode 2 of The Donald Trump Show, a novel take on the American president's second term in office. Thursday, 18th of September. BBC One. At 8 p.m, there's MasterChef, with contestants recreating some of Heston Blumenthal's iconic dishes. At 9, there's the next episode of Stranded on Love Island, when a crate washes up bringing much-needed support from home. But it's not all good news. BBC Two. At 6:30 a.m, there's Homes Under the Hammer from Dundee, Merseyside and Plymouth. At 8 p.m, there's Saving Lives at Sea, with the rescue of a kayaker from the Farne Islands, a man from a rip current, and a dog walker. At 9, there's the third episode of the Aussie drama The Newsreader, with Dale hosting a lavish birthday party and Helen worrying about dire ratings. At 10 p.m, there's the second episode of Missing in Paradise, Searching for Psalm, ITV. At 9 p.m, there's a new series of Long Lost Family, when Davina McCall and Nikki Campbell follow people searching for their birth families. At 10:45, there's the film The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard, an action-comedy sequel starring Ryan Reynolds and Samuel L. Jackson. Channel 4. At 8 p.m, we have The Doghouse, with several dogs needing new homes. And at 9, there's Taskmaster, with more bizarre challenges for the celebrities, from rotating around a hill of bread flour to finding something surprising inside a fake fish. Friday, 19th of September. BBC One. At 8:30 p.m, MasterChef continues, with the challenge being for the remaining cooks to create a meal out of ingredients they don't like. Who will go forward into finals week? At 9, Stranded on Honeymoon Island sees suspicion and speculation sparking up, while an unexpected guest sends shockwaves through the masquerade ball. At 10:40, there's the film Knocked Up, a romantic comedy about a high-flying TV journalist whose one-night stand with a laid-back slacker results in her pregnancy. BBC Two. At 6:30 a.m, Homes Under the Hammer visits properties in Staffordshire, South East London and Greater Manchester. At 10 p.m, there's the final episode of Missing in Paradise, Searching for Psalm. And at 11 p.m, the evening's programmes on BBC Two conclude with the film Selma, a true-life drama about Dr. Martin Luther King, the civil rights activist, and how what he initiated in Selma in 1965 changed the face of America. Channel 4. At 8 p.m, there's The Great British Bake Off, An Extra Slice, where Joe Brand and Tom Allen digest Bread Week and scrutinise audience cakes. At 9, there's Gogglebox, with armchair critics sharing their opinions with us. At 10 p.m, there's Mitchell and Webb Are Not Helping. Sketches from this comedy duo include A Very Bad Spy, a new board game about the great taste of bran, and another heartbreaking instalment of sweary Aussie drama. Be prepared to weep with laughter. And that's the end of my choice of programmes for you this week. I hope you find something of interest. Goodbye.
TNF Soundings.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, September 13th. And where might you find gathered together two comedians, actors, writers, a psychologist and a beekeeper? Well, the answer is on Radio 4 at 9 o'clock, Saturday Live with Adrian Chiles. Now, the plays of the Russian writer Anton Chekhov can be an acquired taste, but The Seagull on Radio 4 Extra has a host of characters brought together on a Russian country estate, and the interplay between them involves us from the start. The production was recorded on location, has a star-studded cast including Helen Bonham Carter and Robert Glenister. The Seagull is on Radio 4 Extra Saturday afternoon at 12:15, or repeated at 6:15. It's been quite the season of the proms in the last few weeks, and Saturday sees the last night of the proms. If you want to be among the millions of listeners tuning in to live coverage of the Royal Albert Hall for this annual event, Radio 3, 7 p.m. Saturday. Sunday, September 14th, on the Radio 4 programme, in which guests are invited to talk about past events that have affected their lives, has proved incredibly popular over the last few years, and this broadcast will be no exception. Famous former students of the Royal Ballet School talk about its influence and legacy. It's with Kirsty Walk, who chairs the reunion, 10 a.m, Radio 4, on Sunday morning. Genius, what is it? Who has it? And can it embrace artists, composers, writers, scientists, whatever it is? The Words and Music broadcast at 6 o'clock on Radio 3 presents a sequence of poetry, prose and music on the theme of genius. Words and Music, 6 p.m, Radio 3, Sunday. And whether or not you could apply the word genius to the subject of our next suggestion is a moot point, but she's described in the Radio Times as a virtuoso singer with a broad range, an actor, comedian, composer and multilinguist. How many of us, I wonder, are familiar with her name? Well, between the years, the thousand voices of Kathy Berberian, Radio 3, 7:15 p.m, to find out. On to programmes then that are broadcast at the same time, all week, Monday to Friday, same radio station. Same time, same radio station, Monday to Friday, all week. And the BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, reads her history of modern Afghanistan through the stories of the staff who have kept the doors of Kabul's Intercontinental Hotel open throughout the country's turbulent history. It's Book of the Week, The Finest Hotel in Kabul, Radio 4, all week, at 11:45 in the morning. On to the BBC National Short Story Award. And the names of the contenders are under wraps, but there will be a story every afternoon with the winner announced on Front Row at the end of the month. The BBC National Short Story Award. There are five stories this week. Radio 4, 3:30 in the afternoon, all week. Apart from Friday, when it's at 11:30 p.m. And Book of Bedtime has the story about a preacher's wife in North Yorkshire and her encounters with the Bronte family. At first, her only company is Anne Bronte, until Anne's dissolute brother Branwell arrives. Small surprise, perhaps, the first episode is entitled Temptation. The book is Mrs. Robinson. It's on Radio 4 at 10:45 p.m. Book of Bedtime, read by Anne-Marie Duff this week. On to the rest of the highlights for the week, starting with Tuesday, September 16th. We know, I'm sure, the horrific injuries suffered by thousands of soldiers in the First World War. In the following programme, we can learn of the work of one doctor who was tasked with rebuilding the shattered faces of soldiers thus injured. The programme is aptly entitled History's Heroes, Saving Face. Harold Gillis, Radio 4, 3 o'clock, Tuesday afternoon. Now, in this broadcast, poet Gwyneth Lewis explores the tension and tenderness within the marriage of the poet Thomas and the artist Eldridge. She considers what can be learned about art and love from this remarkable relationship. Love's Moment, R.S. Thomas and Mildred Eldridge, Radio 4, 4 o'clock, Tuesday afternoon. Peter White presents his regular broadcast for the visually impaired, In Touch, Radio 4, 8:40 p.m. And immediately after that, Jamie Cullen presents a broad spectrum of jazz music, including live studio sessions. It's Radio 2 for this, The Jazz Show with Jamie Cullen, 9 o'clock on Tuesday night. Wednesday, September 17th, and a popular broadcast worth tuning into if you haven't already, explains some of the numbers and statistics encountered in everyday life. More or Less is presented by Tim Harford, Radio 4, 9:30 in the morning. Our next suggestion should give us pause for thought. A team from the Prison Inspectorate visit one of His Majesty's prisons in this unsentimental and realistic documentary, which puts the jail, not the prisoners, on trial. We could be shocked by the conditions the team encounter. Even the Radio Times writer asks, what chance is there of any meaningful rehabilitation? A Prisoner Inspector Calls is on Radio 4 on Wednesday morning at 11. And Poor Tom is a chimney sweep, reborn into a mysterious aquatic paradise. What am I talking about? A dramatisation starring the late Timothy West. Water Babies is on Radio 4 Extra at 9 p.m. on Wednesday. And you'll find the next two episodes on Thursday and Friday at the same time. Thursday, September 18th. And High Cockalorum is a true story set in West Yorkshire in 1978. Hollywood superstar James Mason and a humble lad are thrown together by circumstance, creating an unlikely partnership. It stars Steve Pemberton and Rhys Shearsmith. Hi Cockalorum is on Radio 4 at 2:15 Thursday afternoon. Are you familiar with Fair Isle sweaters? Perhaps you have one or need to buy one. Well, the birthplace of the sweater on these isolated islands is famous for its knitting and birds, as Martha Carney discovers in open country on Radio 4, Thursday afternoon at 3. And lastly for Thursday, startling insights from this programme. The single-cell creatures that don't share a brain cell between them yet can communicate and trade information about survival. I'm talking about bacteria, and some are beneficial. The aim for the majority of them is to make us ill. As the Radio Times critic reports, I listened, often open-mouthed. The programme is The Social Lives of Bacteria on BBC World Service at 8:05 on Thursday night. Finally, Friday, September 19th. Is the English cuppa under threat from matcha? Talking about the global sales of this Japanese-powered green tea that's continuing to rise. We'll find out more about it in the food programme, The Rise of Matcha, 11 a.m. on Radio 4. The master of English comedy writing for many is P.G. Woodhouse, and the dramatisation of The Inimitable Jeeves is on Radio 4 Extra at 12:30 on Friday lunchtime. And finally, how to comfort Ukrainian soldiers coping with life and death in the trenches. This and other questions form the content of Heart and Soul on BBC World Service at 1:30 in the afternoon. Lucy Ash hears from military chaplains and priests on both sides of the war and explores the significance of religion and faith during wartime. That's it. Thank you to Terry for the highlights this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening.
TNS Soundings.
News and information from Sandwell Council. World Suicide Prevention Day. Let's get men talking in Sandwell. UAK Mate is a new public health campaign being launched in Sandwell to tackle the stigma surrounding men's mental health and encourage more men to talk about their mental health and reach out for support. The campaign, which launches Wednesday the 10th of September, features photos and videos of local men talking about their own mental health experiences, aiming to change the narrative about men's mental health. Suicide prevention is everybody's business. Every day, 17 people lose their lives to suicide in the UK. Suicide is the biggest killer of men under the age of 50, and men make up 75% of suicides nationally. In Sandwell, 79% of deaths by suicide are men. Men are also less likely to seek help for their mental health. Councillor Jackie Taylor, Sandwell Council's Cabinet Member for Adult Social Care, Health and Wellbeing, said, "As we mark World Suicide Prevention Day, we are encouraging everyone, regardless of gender, to talk openly about mental health. Please ask for help if you are experiencing mental ill health. There's lots of support available, and it's a brave step towards making things better. The figures highlight the urgent need to create a culture where men feel able to talk openly and seek support before reaching crisis point. We need to break the silence, challenge the stigma, and get men talking across our communities. We need men to ask their mates if they're okay. Thank you to everyone who has shared their experiences as part of this new campaign. Together, we can create the space for honest conversations and support when it's needed most. You can visit healthysandwell.co.uk/UOKMate for more details of the UOKMate campaign and support available. For advice on a wide range of mental health support services available in Sandwell, visit healthysandwell.co.uk/healthy-mind. Or you can call Healthy Sandwell for free on 0800 011 4656. If you are experiencing a mental health crisis, please call NHS 111 and choose option 2, and you will be directed to local crisis support. You can also call Samaritans for free on 116 123 or via the Samaritans website. Domestic abuse can have a severe and lasting impact on mental health and emotional well-being for both adults and children. If you are experiencing domestic abuse, visit sandwell.gov.uk/domestic-abuse for details of support services available. Always dial 999 in an emergency. Specialist domestic abuse support is available via the Black Country Women's Aid, who offer support for women, men and children. Their contact number is 0121 552 6448. Ask Mark offers help and support for men. Their contact number is 0121 289 6402. And Birmingham LGBT Centre, their contact number is 0121 643 0821.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, I'm Mary Buckley, and this article called Smart Glasses, Seeing is Believing was written by Lindsay. The first thing that comes to mind when hearing the term smart glasses is a pair of spectacles with a fancy modern frame to look fashionable. However, there are two angles to that these days, as looking smart has now been combined with clever smart in the form of artificial intelligence. Several companies are now marketing reasonably affordable smart glasses, costing from around £300 to £500. This puts them in the same price range as a high-quality mid-range smartphone. Of course, a standard smartphone can take photographs, speak, text, and assist with information searches. So what about the AI smart glasses? Well, they have specific functions for those with visual impairment or total sight loss. AI-operated smart glasses, although having been available from 2023, have only become legally available in the UK to those with vision loss since April 2025. There are several manufacturers, all with slight variations of product, but all with the aim of providing sight and understanding of the environment to those who need visual assistance in their day-to-day lives. These AI smart glasses can do numerous tasks, mostly controlled by voice activation. For example, they can read aloud items like letters, signs or menus. They can audio describe scenery around the wearer when out and about, including what street they might be on, and safety essentials such as the location of Pelican Crossings. When meeting up with familiar people, the glasses can learn these faces and then announce who they are to the wearer. In addition, certain brands of smart glasses have extra assistance features built in. For example, Envision glasses, which use the Google Glass Enterprise Edition 2 platform software, can support multi-languages, read handwriting, and even detect light levels. The Ray-Ban Meta smart glasses specialise in look-and-tell software, enabling the wearer to interact with advanced multimodal AI in the glasses by asking real-time questions about objects, reading material, or navigating environments. The glasses give immediate spoken responses, thus guiding the wearer and enhancing situational awareness. The only downside to these models of smart glasses is that they require linking to and the use of a smartphone and a special app to work. For anyone with some remaining usable vision, most smart glasses can include prescription lenses. Here are examples of three basic brand options. eSight offers high-resolution displays and real-time video processing of images seen by the wearer. Orcam MyEye 3 Pro includes a text, face, colour, money and barcode recognition device which can fit magnetically onto regular glasses. However, going forward, these glasses may not be as well supported as other brands as their functions are independent of the internet. Dot Lumen glasses are all about spatial awareness and helping the wearer safely navigate social and difficult scenarios such as crowded streets or staircases. They do this by utilising ultrasonic sensor information detected from obstacles in real time. So, there seems to be plenty of advantages of AI smart glasses, but what about the disadvantages? Currently, smart glasses offer only about 5 or 6 hours of battery life on a single charge, and surprisingly, some models are less water resistant than others in daily use. Also, like any electronic assistive technology, there may be times when the glasses lose power or break down. This makes it advisable to have a backup mobility aid to hand, such as a long cane, as an extra means of navigating your way around if necessary. With multiple options available, it's important to spend time working out which smart glasses can work best for you before investing your money. If you are considering a purchase, always make sure that you check several options to make sure that you find the glasses that are best suited to your individual requirements and lifestyle.
TNF Soundings.
Virtual coffee and conversation invitation each Wednesday from 12 p.m. to 1:30 p.m. Weekly virtual coffee and a chat using Zoom. You will need a device that can connect to the internet, such as a smartphone, tablet or computer with a microphone. Most laptop computers have a built-in microphone and camera, or you may have a webcam already set up. It will be first come, first served. So would you please indicate if you will be attending by contacting SVI by emailing info@sandwellvisuallyimpaired.org.uk. A Zoom meeting invitation will be sent to the first 8 people who respond. Please note, if you have been part of the conversation previously, you will still have to respond confirming you wish to participate as a fresh invite is produced for every session. We will also include links for you to download the Zoom app to your devices for both Android and iOS users on your first time of participating. If you don't get through this time, don't worry. You will be added to the next coffee and conversation meeting. Telephone 0121 525 4810. Email info@sandwellvisuallyimpaired.org.uk.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, I'm Tanya, reading this article written by Lindsay, and it's called Touching on Sculpture. Throughout the UK, be it in shops, galleries, exhibitions, stately homes, or other public places, there has long been a taboo about visitors touching sculptural pieces of art. And history has shown the folly of allowing touching, with many a priceless artefact being damaged. But if you are visually impaired, often touching a sculpture is the best way to get a sense of an artwork. Two exhibitions this year are challenging the norm by offering opportunities to get hands-on with art. And while this year's exhibitions may not be close to where you live, let's hope the idea of tactile art starts to become more widespread. Ironically, it was through irreparable damage to a popular natural feature that one of the tactile exhibitions came into existence. Northumberland is now host to a huggable sculpture, along with associated tactile visitor seating benches. The sculptures and benches are made of wood salvaged from the senseless illegal cutting down of the famous sycamore gap tree in 2023 at Craglough, near Hadrian's Wall in Northumberland. The public were appalled and devastated when the 150-year-old iconic sycamore tree was unceremoniously felled. Many people treasured special memories of the tree, and thousands of emails, letters and messages in visitors' books flooded the Northumberland National Park Authority, the NNPA, creating no small task for the Reading staff members. The Park Authority decided to salvage the sycamore wood and commissioned artist Charlie Winnie with the Creative Communities Art Collective to create a sustainable artistic interpretation sculpture so the public could continue to appreciate the legendary tree. The actual design stemmed from public feedback through workshops with children to noting down comments made to the NNPA. What became clear was that people wanted to sit down beside the tree and physically touch the sycamore's bark again. Charlie mostly works with steam-bent wood, and so twisting and smoothing some elegant wooden benches from strips of different colour-toned wood was simple enough. But then he added some end poles shaped like cooked spaghetti pieces to reach up and across the ceiling like a flowing open framework of artificial branches. To further address the memorial element, each individual curved branch had lettering burnt into its surface of various inspirational statements concerning hope and nature. In the centre of the floor, surrounded by the three smooth, varnished, curvy wooden benches, stands an upright section of the sycamore's trunk. It's more than 6 feet tall and comes complete with its original bark. The trunk was a little difficult to assemble, needing its own bespoke metal support to enable permanent display and, of course, remain truly huggable. The sycamore gap tree is free to enter. It opened in summer 2025 and can be found at the Sill National Landscape Discovery Centre near Hadrian's Wall in Northumberland. Their website has more details at thesill.org.uk, and to spell that, it is T-H-E, the S-I-L-L .org.uk. Planning ahead for future huggable trees, another legacy of the sycamore gap tree is the National Trust's Trees of Hope campaign, offering an opportunity for publicly accessible spaces to plant one of the 49 saplings grown from the seeds of the famous tree. This number relates to the original adult tree's full height of 49 feet. Across the UK, more than 500 places applied for the saplings, which will be planted this coming winter. The 49 successful bidders have now been named, so keep an ear open to find out if any of the saplings will be appearing in your area. We can't name all 49 locations here, but they include sites such as Coventry Tree Sanctuary, Alderhay Children's Hospital in Liverpool, Alice Park Trust in Bath, Battersea Park in London, Parks Trust in Milton Keynes, Ryde Academy, Isle of Wight, and Balfour Memorial Garden in Orkney. Our second tactile art exhibition starts this November at the Henry Moore Institute in West Yorkshire. It's called Beyond the Visual and will put an emphasis on accessible yet contemporary tactile sculptures. It's intended as a showcase of inclusive art in close collaboration with blind and non-blind artists to challenge the dominance of sight in the making and appreciation of art. Over the past 3 years, shaping this research project in interactive art has involved Professor Ken Wilder from the University of Arts London, alongside Dr. Aaron McPeak, a visually impaired contemporary artist, an associate lecturer at Chelsea College of Arts, and Dr. Claire O'Dowd from the Henry Moore Institute.
They have worked in conjunction with Shape Arts, the UK's leading disability-led art organisation. The project has also been supported by the Arts and Humanities Research Council's inaugural exhibition fund, which provides major grants for innovative and collaborative exhibitions. Beyond the Visual, as the title would suggest, is intended to push the boundaries of the senses in multiple ways. It includes a curator who has discussed each piece with the actual artist involved and provides accurate audio description along with opportunities to touch, handle, listen and interact with various modern art pieces. The artists and organisers' main aim is to challenge the physical, cultural and societal conventions usually associated with galleries and exhibitions by rethinking how visitors experience and explore sculptural art. Entry is free to the Beyond the Visual exhibition, which will be held at the Sculpture Galleries and Study Gallery, the Henry Moore Institute, Leeds, from the 28th of November through to the 8th of March 2026. Further details are available on the website henry-moore.org/watts-on/beyond-the-visual, and to spell that, it is Henry, H-E-N-R-Y, dash M-O-O-R-E dot O-R-G /WHATS-ON/BEYOND-THE-VISUAL. Thank you.
TNF Soundings.
So to our final item, which I wanted to include last week, but the equipment let me down. Or really, to be truthful, we were in too much of a hurry and I didn't allow the recorder to settle down properly to make sure it was recording. This time we got it right. I'm taking bits out of the recording, which totaled an hour and a half or more, so it's quite difficult to find the bits that were Keith Hodgkins, who is an expert in Tipton history, particularly industrial history. And this is from the standpoint of the canal system, which of course in this part of the world is very extensive. This is the introduction where we met on the new market area car park in Breitbridge, just up the road from Asda. It's an introduction to a long walk, did last for quite a time. So I hope you enjoy this first part of the Great Bridge to Ocker Hill walk.
Okay, we're on record. So, morning folks, welcome to Great Bridge. Great Bridge is a funny place really, because it's, although it's Tipton, it always goes as Tipton. It's actually split in between half in Tipton and half in West Bromwich. And the boundaries on the River Tyne, which flows under the main road just about 50 yards from where we're standing. You can actually look over the parapet and see the River Tyne. But we're actually standing in the Tipton half now, Tipton proper, because that's the old parish boundary. And those of you who are old enough might remember the old market in Great Bridge, which was in front of the Limerick, a little triangular piece of land just in front of the Limerick, which was great, a lovely little market. But that finished in 1971, and they relocated it in Mill Street further up there, which was no good because it was just out of the centre. So Great Bridge has never been the same since they did away with the old traditional market. There was a covered market, which I think that's closed now, isn't it? It's closed now. It was further at the West Bromwich end. And then Sandwell Council, about 10 or 15 years ago, built this area here. I think it was a good attempt to recreate a market with the shelter and quite a lot of open space and parking. But it's never taken off, sadly. It's such a shame because it's a good development, really, right in the middle of the town. But it, for some reason, it just hasn't taken off. So What we're going to do today is we're going to walk up to Ocker Hill along the canal and walk back along the road. So it's a circular walk in a way, but it isn't circular. It's sort of long, you know, it's a straight line up and a straight line back, but slightly different routes. So canals is the main theme, as it was last week for those of you who came on the Tipton Canals walk. And we're actually right now, we're standing on an old canal, because there was a branch canal which left the main canal just over there and went under the main road in Great Bridge just here. And on the other side of the road, you can still trace it, because it's still a footpath that goes up. And the canal eventually went on to what is now Sheepwash Park. And it was built to serve brickworks and collieries in the early 19th century. But it fell into disuse in the 60s and was filled in. But they did do a walkway along part of it here, which is called the... it's now called Fred Perry Way, isn't it? After Fred Perry, who was a local councillor and a very, you know, a great community activist in Great Bridge.
There's a little sign over there, I've just noticed.
Yeah, that's right. There's a little street sign which marks the footpath. So we're going to set off, and our first stop is only about 50 yards away, because there's a piece of public art here which I want you to look at, which probably nobody notices because it's tucked out the way. But anyway, here we go. Right, this is an artwork that was installed by the Black Country Development Corporation. Remember them? They brought about the construction of the new Link Road and the Black Country New Road. And this is an artwork which was supposed to be visible from the road, but of course, as you can see now, trees have grown up, you can't see it. And as it's tucked at the back of the car park, I bet most people in Great Bridge don't even know it's here. But it's meant to represent local industry. You can see those figures at the top. You can see a boat, and that is the Aaron Manby, which was the world's first steam-powered iron ship, which was built at Horsley just up the road. And there is a plate here which is getting overgrown, which tells you all about it. So I'll read what it says on the plate. And it's called, the artwork is called Great Bridge, Past and Future. And it says, designed by pupils of Alexandra High School with help from artists Julie Edwards and Ron Thompson. The sculpture represents the Great Bridge crossed by Cromwell's troops and the industrial heritage of this area, including the Aaron Manby, which was the first iron-hulled steamship in the world and was built in Tipton in 1822. Other features suggest hope and prosperity for the future. And it was opened on the 14th of July, 2009. Did anybody seen it before? Yeah, so you weren't aware of it. So it needs to be, I think it needs to be relocated, really. Maybe in front of the Limerick, so it can be more visible. Okay, we're going across now to join onto Brickhouse Lane. And we're going to cross over a little bridge over the River Tame before we reach Brickhouse Lane.
I'll be including some more outtakes from that long recording next week. But over to Pam, who was with me on that walk, for a round of thanks to our readers and the team.
Thank you to all our Sandwell Talking News volunteers who've read the Express and Star articles for us this week. Back to normality again now, with the summer holidays being over, so we've got more regular teams of readers together now. Thanks to James, Debbie, Lauren, Sarbjit, Jenny and Kate. Welcome back to Sarah Ann doing the quiz again. Thanks to Sue for picking the articles everyone's read. Thanks to Cyrita for uploading everything to the websites. And thanks, of course, to Tony and Ray and Gavin for all the work they do with editing and putting everything on CD and USB sticks. Well, looks like the autumn's upon us now, with the weather changing from all that heat. Unfortunately, spiders coming in as well, I see. Have a good week, everybody.
And thank you also to you, Pam, and all the team, as I say, she was with me on the canal walk, describing all the nature as we went along. And it's quite a nature walk as well as an industrial canal walk, if a bit smelly. It was very nice when she was telling me about the moorhens. Sorry about that interruption, but do this at home, so people do phone me from time to time. As I was saying, it's very nice, Pam, telling me about the moorhens and the dragonflies and the wildlife along the canal. And it's quite a wildlife walk, if a rather smelly one, on that stretch from Great Bridge to Ocker Hill. In the afternoon, I recorded another talk, which I'm going to include excerpts from in the near future. A chap related to Sue Clovier, who was a reporter journalist with the Express and Star. He doesn't work for them anymore because they employ far fewer people, and I think a lot of them are freelance these days anyway. But he did work for the Express and Star some 30 years ago. That's another interesting series of excerpts I will be including in the next month or so. I did get quite wet in the afternoon coming back from that talk, which was the same day as the canal walk. The thunder was right overhead, so I did get quite wet going along All Saints Way to get the bus back into West Bromwich. So I hope you've enjoyed this edition, and we'll be back with you, of course, next week. Thanks to Tony and Gavin, by the way, for the postal distribution at the Town Hall. And do remember to get the pen drives back to us as soon as possible, please. But for now, I'll sign off. Wish you all a pleasant week, what's left of the summer, which is going to be very rainy. And I think we really have seen the last of the summer, although it could be quite warm in the middle of the day and the early afternoon. But for now, it's bye-bye from me, Ray, and all the team. And see you next week.
To use our talk phone service to listen to Sandwell Talking News or leave us a message, phone 0121 699 6696. If you are using a landline in the 0121 area, then just dial 699 6696.